I did not record the podcast. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not record it. I did not. Oh, hi, audience, and welcome to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is man who betrayed me and is just a chicken. Cheep, 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 cheep.
It's Mike DiCriscio. That's me.
How you doing today, Mike?
I am delighted, Mike, at just everything that just happened. You have to stick to that character now. You're in it for the next hour and a half.
I am kind of the James Franco of this podcast in many ways. More ways than one. And I won't go into what ways those are, but trust me, there are ways.
There, sure. Yeah.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we will move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director James Franco, The Disaster Artist. Are you ready to dig into The Disaster Artist, Mike?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot to talk about with this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot to dig into. And are you familiar? I mean, we'll get into this later on, but are you familiar? Well, you were familiar with The Room, I assume.
Yes. I have a very good story about how I first saw The Room.
Oh, good. I'm very excited to hear that later on. I'm very curious to know how The Disaster Artist would play for somebody who had no idea what The Room was.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it would play very differently than if you know the Room pretty well, like we do. But in any case, you're going to be hearing a review of The Disaster Artist from two Room aficionados.
That's a strong title to be associated with, but okay.
People who have seen The Room at least once.
There we go. All right.
Coming up later on. But first, we got to get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news. Film news.
All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, Mike, and we begin with probably the biggest news in the entire film industry over the past couple of weeks.
Shrek 5 finally has a release date.
You're damn right, Shrek 5, 2026 or whatever, I don't know. How long ago was it that they announced they were doing Shrek 5 and we've heard nothing about a release date of that movie?
I don't know. Yeah. Colin, check the episodes for us.
He runs the minutes of the podcast, you know. Shrek 5 is not the news that we're talking about. Although if Disney gets its hands on it, then who knows? Maybe it will. Disney is probably buying 20th Century Fox to the tune of $60 billion.
That's a lot of dollars.
That is so many dollars. And, you know, people have been reporting about this a lot. There's probably going to be a deal reached about this sometime this week or next week. And people have been reporting this in the context of, like, Marvel news and Star Wars news, because there are some things that could happen if Disney buys Fox. The X-Men could come back to the Marvel Universe. Fox has the rights to the original Star Wars trilogy, so Disney could release the unaltered, original, non-special edition version of the Star Wars movies on Blu-ray, which would be pretty cool. And those are things that, you know, yeah, it'd be cool. But I feel like this is bad, right? This seems like something that would be horrible.
In
terms of like a monopoly.
Yeah, there's like, you know, there's whole laws about this not being able to be a thing. Antitrust laws and anti-monopoly laws and stuff.
That's what I've been saying, but nobody seems to agree with me on that.
Yeah, but like that Marvel news, though. So
yeah, that's all anybody's reporting about this.
I'll sign over my, any chance of creativity and new things happening from small people, and just let Disney run literally everything.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of the context with this whole thing. Yeah, and you know, Disney swallowing up 20th Century Fox, that's probably the biggest studio swallowing up one of the other biggest studios. They would have power, you know, unseen since like the 1920s in Hollywood.
Yeah,
when there were only like three studios.
Yeah, exactly. We had the studio system. They broke them all up into tiny little ones. And, you know, United Artists was like the independent one and all this stuff. And now everything is just back to the same three studios, I think. the same three studios.
There are currently like six major studios, and they all have like subdivisions with like different film production companies. A lot of them are owned by the studios and stuff like that. A lot of them have independent arms, like 20th Century Fox has Fox Searchlight. I don't know what would happen to that if Disney swallowed up Fox. Fox is so many things, and Disney taking over Fox would be, I mean, so many. Like, for example, Fox owns a 30% stake in Hulu, and Disney already owns like 30% of Hulu. which would make them the majority owner of Hulu if they bought Fox. So I don't know what that would mean for their Disney streaming service that they're trying to make, if they would just put all that stuff on Hulu or whatever. That could be a thing, but they would essentially own that. Apparently what's going on is Fox wants to sell off their entire entertainment and like film and TV division and just focus on being a news and sports organization. And so the fact that Disney's giving them $60 billion to do that is kind of upsetting because Fox News is evil.
Just straight up.
Yeah. So, you know, like, yeah, we'd be getting the unaltered Star Wars trilogy, but at the cost of Fox News essentially gaining like perpetual money from now until the end of time, which isn't really a great trade-off.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the ramifications of this merger, what happens as we move to the future of Disney and Google and Amazon, I guess, being the only companies left. Which, like, all right, I guess that's a pretty convenient future.
I guess. Yeah, but in terms of the content and stuff, like, you know, the Star Wars news would be the only one that I'd be kind of excited about, getting the original ones on Blu-ray. As for the X-Men, like, I'm kind of okay with them just being in their own universe, you know? Like, I feel like, you know, the movies like Logan and Deadpool, like, Disney wouldn't have made those movies.
No, those characters, as they are in Logan and they are in Deadpool, do not fit the Marvel universe. And I want those characters, right? I don't want like the bubbly version of Wolverine or whatever, you know, like whatever we would get like that.
Yeah, like I'm sure there's a lot of fun stuff that the you could do in the Marvel universe with the X-Men, but I feel like we just like Fox, even though they're like hit or miss with the X-Men movies, like, you know, X-Men Apocalypse wasn't great. I'm going to bet the Dark Phoenix is probably not very good, but I'm just throwing that out there now that it's probably not going to be. But
yeah,
you know, I think they're giving different different people, different voices, different characters to just kind of run with right now. They gave James Mangold Logan. They just gave James Franco a Multiple Man movie. Like, who? Nobody thought that would happen. Nobody asked for that, but it's happening apparently. No. Or it might be happening now. Who knows if Disney puts the kibosh on that if they end up buying Fox? There's a lot of things in the air, and I also think like Fox owns so many properties that Disney probably has no need for. They probably don't want like Alien, like Die Hard, like Predator. There's stuff like that that it's like Disney's probably not going to release those, and so they'll probably just kind of sit on the shelf.
Yeah, imagine if they tried to pull like their Disney Vault bullshit with like just every movie. Just like, nope, Die Hard's in the vault. Can't get it for 15 years. That'd be bizarre.
That would be horrifying. I don't think they can do that. They really don't do the vault anymore. I don't think anyway, right? I feel that was more of a relic of the VHS era where they wanted to drive sales of VHSs.
I know definitely within the last like 5 years, it was still a hardcore thing. Like when I was working at FYE, people would come in looking for Lion King. Nope, in the vault. Can't get it. Really? Doesn't exist. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it might be out now. Like it might be a Blu-ray and stuff now. But at the time, like they were releasing like the Diamond Edition, like the 50th anniversary of a lot of movies at the time. I can't remember exactly what movies it was, but like those were movies that were coming out of the vault for their 50th anniversary. So like within pretty recent time, that's still a thing, and it's fucking dumb, and I hate it.
It is the worst.
That's the moral of that story.
I mean, I think the Disney Vault is going to go away in favor of the Disney streaming service, whatever that ends up being. And so they're pulling all their movies from Netflix and stuff at some point, and they're going to just put all that stuff on their own streaming service or on Hulu if they end up owning Hulu and rebranding it as a Disney thing.
Adding, you know, Fox's entire filmography to also their streaming service is a huge boost to having more than just Disney, you know, classic quote unquote Disney movies.
Like Disney stuff, like Disney, Marvel and Star Wars, Pixar and like all that by themselves is enough to get a lot of people on their streaming service. But having the entire catalog of 20th Century Fox, which includes Alien and like I said, Alien, Die Hard, Predator, and so many other franchises and movies and stuff, like that's a lot. That's a lot to, you know, that's, you know, half of movies for the last
pretty much
for the last 50 years or so. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I think the streaming service is actually kind of the big thing about this. Disney wants to launch that and make that a huge thing. I think their main competition is Netflix right now. Birth, Movies, Death actually had a great article a couple days ago called Is the Disney Fox Faster Than the Netflix Hare? And it was about this Disney Fox merger that could be happening. And it kind of gave a lot of the business insight into this. So I would recommend reading that. If you haven't already, but it's it kind of shows you that Disney really wants their own streaming service. So I could see something like, you know, where they kind of do what Netflix is doing and just give a lot of money to different people to make stuff for their own service. Like if Ridley Scott wants to make that third David movie in the Alien franchise, which I think he does, then, you know, they can maybe push that to streaming or something instead of the theatrical release.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of a bummer for me because I love seeing Ridley Scott's movies on the big screen. But, you know, honestly, actually, when I was reading the article and I read that 20th Century Fox's Alien and Disney probably doesn't want anything to do with it, I was like, oh, man, like, are they going to cancel Ridley Scott's third David movie? I'm going to be so fucking upset.
You said alone by yourself in the whole planet.
Yeah.
I mean, I would also be really upset about that.
I just got Alien Covenant on Blu-ray. I plan on watching it pretty soon, actually.
Disney got Congress to change the laws around copyright because of Mickey Mouse. Like, yeah. I wouldn't put it past them to pull some shit with buying Fox just to fuck up a lot of stuff.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. So, yeah, Disney, essentially, they're the evil empire, and we'll be reviewing Star Wars The Last Jedi next week.
Can't wait.
It's going to be awesome. But let's move on from the Disney stuff, and we got some other pretty major film news going on this week. Like, Bryan Singer, director of the X-Men movies, weirdly enough, also the director of Superman Returns and The Usual Suspects. He was directing a biopic on Freddie Mercury, the lead singer of Queen, called Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's been filming for quite some time, and he has been fired from Bohemian Rhapsody just 2 weeks to go before the movie wrapped filming. Apparently, Singer had disappeared from set for a few days, just without a trace. Nobody had heard from him, and he was fighting with star Rami Malek throughout the entirety of filming, and apparently him disappearing is not the first time that's happened during during a movie that he's worked on. He disappeared for a few days in Superman Returns and during X-Men Apocalypse. And then a few days after he was fired, he was sued for raping a 17-year-old. So
yeah,
there it is.
Just Bryan Singer things, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting for the sexual assault news to drop on Bryan Singer for quite a while. He seemed that's kind of the surprising thing is, like, he was like the first one I thought of when all this stuff started happening. Like, he's got to be one of the first ones to fall, and he wasn't. And, you know, maybe it was because he was they've been taking time to work on the story or whatever. But yeah, rumors about him have been spreading for years, like literally years. Like, it wasn't even like a lot of these people who have been revealed as sexual predators, like, I had no idea about. Bryan Singer, like, that was in the public. Like, everybody knew. There's actually a documentary about Bryan Singer being a sexual predator.
Really?
Like, legit.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I think came out years ago.
I had heard a few years ago, he was one of the first people to kind of get – not first people, but you know what I mean. Recent memory, I guess, exposed for all that stuff and then kind of fell back under the radar as they tend to do or used to do, I guess. So, I mean, if it's one less awful human being doing stuff, that's like probably for the best.
I would agree with that. Anyway, he has been replaced on Bohemian Rhapsody. With Ron Howard, fresh off the heels of Solo. No, that didn't.
Oh, whoa, weird.
Yeah, I think that would be great if Ron Howard just like jumped in and being like, I've got experience jumping in at the last minute. I can do this now.
He's just the perpetual guy, like the backfill guy for every movie.
He replaces Kevin Spacey and all the money in the world. Like, hey, it's Ron Howard.
But it's only his voiceover from Arrested Development.
Yes, I would love it. He was replaced with Dexter Fletcher, the director of Eddie the Eagle, which came out a couple years ago. So we'll see what happens with Bohemian Rhapsody. This movie has been a pretty troubled production for a long time. Like, it's been in the works for like 10 years. Sacha Baron Cohen was supposed to be in it for a long time. I guess the members of Queen, Brian May, are saying they want it to be less of a Freddie Mercury biopic and more of a Queen biopic, which to me is far less interesting than a Freddie Mercury
That kind of defeats the purpose, I think.
Yeah.
But
from what I read, like, the movie that they're making doesn't even end with like Freddie Mercury dying. It kind of doesn't even delve into like the negative stuff of Freddie Mercury's life. You know, it's kind of just like the rise of Queen, and that's like the movie. And it's like, I mean, like, I like Queen music, so I'll probably see it.
I mean, I guess.
But yeah, so it is a weird situation all around. This movie's been in the works for so long, and you know, you would think it's finally underway, and it's still an uphill battle for this movie, essentially.
Yeah,
Which is a shame, but it is coming out next year. Now under the direction of Dexter Fletcher, so we'll see how it turns out. Also, we got a couple of what the fuck news happening here, Mike. First of all, wanted to bring up Detective Pikachu.
Just to remind everyone that's a thing.
Just to remind everyone that it exists. We talked about it a long time ago,
Like, yeah, Colin, check the minutes.
Yeah, check the minutes, Colin. We talked about it a long time. It had to have been like over a year ago that we talked about Detective Pikachu when they first announced this movie. And basically, Detective Pikachu is a video game based on the Pokemon series, and it's like Pikachu as a detective, obviously. And he like talks, and it's like kind of like a sort of Pikachu noir almost, like he's solving mysteries or whatever. And that it's a game that has never been released in America, I don't think. It's only been in Japan. But now Ryan Reynolds has been cast as Detective Pikachu for the movie that actually exists.
That's fucking hilarious. That's so stupid.
I almost feel like this is like a gag for Deadpool 2 or something. You know,
it has to be. There's no way.
Like the only post-credits... reason he signed on to this is so they can make a fourth wall joke in Deadpool 2. He's like, I'm Detective Pikachu.
Yeah, the post-credit scene will be of Deadpool 2 will be about Detective Pikachu.
It has to be.
That's the only way this is a thing.
Yeah, so I have nothing really to add about this other than, like, I can't fathom that this exists. Like, if you're going to make a live-action Pokemon movie, Detective Pikachu?
I mean, at least it's going to be, like, Noir-Kachu. No, Pika-Noir, maybe? I can't think of it. I tried.
I mean, Pika-Noir but yeah, better like, than Noir-Kachu, so, yeah, let's go with that.
There we go. I had to workshop it for a second. I mean, at least it's something just absolutely bonkers. Like, I can't believe that they decided on Detective Pikachu.
Yeah, I agree with that. And this is a movie, like, I probably won't end up seeing it, but, like, if I do, at least it'll have, it might have, like, a noir influence. Like, if they just, like, remake The Big Sleep, but with Pikachu.
Holy shit.
In the Humphrey Bogart role. Like, yes. I'm in. 100%.
Naked City or something. Like, that would just be amazing.
Pikachu Marlowe.
Yes, I'm in.
Anyway, so I wanted to bring that up just because it is such a weird news. But yet, we have even more what the fuck news, Mike. We have probably the biggest, like, WTF story of the past couple of years. maybe I won't go that far, but this is certainly very strange. Quentin Tarantino, Mike, hard at work on his Charles Manson movie. It's currently called Number 9. And it actually just announced its release date, which is going to be on the 50th anniversary of the Charles Manson murders on 2019.
Fucking Quentin Tarantino.
So he's going all in on that, which is weird because apparently the movie isn't actually about Charles Manson. Like it's more about the time period, but like Charles Manson is almost in it, like Hitler's Inglourious Bastards kind of thing.
Okay, so yeah,
that's kind of what I hear. But in the meantime, Quentin Tarantino has also pitched a Star Trek movie that J.J. Abrams is running with, apparently. So I guess Tarantino was talking to Abrams, and he like was just talking to him like casually, and he said like, "Oh, I got a great idea for a Star Trek movie." Told J.J. Abrams about it, and Abrams like freaked out. I was like, "That's amazing! That's a great idea." So apparently, J.J. Abrams ran with it, told Paramount. They assembled a writer's room to hear out Tarantino's idea. Tarantino gave them the idea, and it seems like they are producing this movie now with the idea that Tarantino might direct it.
Just what?
And not only that, but Tarantino is not writing the script because they assembled this writer's room. Mark L. Smith, who wrote The Revenant, is kind of the front runner to write the script right now. And it will be rated R.
So, like, I reiterate, what?
Everything about this story seems like it's an April Fool's Day joke.
Is this another Deadpool gag? I swear to God.
This fucking Ryan Reynolds, man, he is just all over the place. But yeah. Yeah, I was so taken aback by this news because Tarantino, you know, he has occasionally stepped out of his own world. He directed Jackie Brown, for example, an adaptation of an Elmore Leonard novel, which apparently he hated doing. He didn't like doing another person's material. He likes to do his own thing. And he's occasionally directed episodes of television. He directed a two-part episode of CSI back in like 2000, 2002, around that time. But even so, like this is unprecedented. And the fact that he might direct this is kind of the thing. I don't think he will.
You know? No, yeah.
You know, and I think if he does, it won't be for several years because he's working on his Manson movie right now, which is coming out in 2019. So I think at the earliest, if Tarantino directs this movie, we're not seeing it until like 2021. But this is insane.
I don't really have like much reaction to this yet, other than it seems like just some shenanigans. I mean, it's cool that Tarantino is pitching a Star Trek movie,
yeah.
or did that already, I guess, successfully. And I know a lot of people are like upset about this, and I guess I get it. Star Trek is so different than anything Tarantino does, just in terms of like tone. Like, Tarantino's usually pretty dour, even though also very funny, but usually pretty cynical, like that kind of take. And that's the opposite of Star Trek, I think, on a lot of stuff.
Yeah. But I think, Tarantino is a pretty huge Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, like, Kill Bill opens with a Star Trek quote, Revenge of the Dishmaster of Cold, old Klingon proverb. You know, he was on the Nerdist podcast around the time Hateful Eight came out. And he actually talked about Star Trek then and about what he would do with a Star Trek movie if he got one.
I do think what could be done, especially rather than just coming up with hokey space stories, except they might be stuck. They might be stuck doing, I mean, you know, hokey or unhokey, they could be fantastic. Yeah. All right. I think they might have trapped themselves a little bit by the simple fact that they have to use all the crew now.
Right.
In all the films. They've established it so much that, you need Uhura. You need a Scotty. You need Bones. You need all that stuff going on all the time. Everybody has to be represented in some big story where they all have to deal. Where I actually think it could be cool, because some of those episodes are fantastic, and the only thing that limited them was their '60s budget, yeah, and 8 days shooting schedule. And even having said that, they did a magnificent job. But you could take some of the great classic Star Trek episodes and just easily expand them to 90 minutes, right, or more.
Right.
And really do some really amazing, amazing stuff. The obvious one would be Sitting on the Edge of Forever, but that's what everyone would go to. But there's a reason why everyone would go to that. It's one of the classic stories of all time.
Yeah. It's interesting.
So if you go on YouTube.com, there's a 7-minute video. Like, I don't think it's the whole thing, but it is like a clip of Tarantino just discussing Star Trek and discussing what he would do with the franchise. And essentially what he's saying is, like, he was such a huge fan of the original series, and he liked Next Generation as well. And he's saying there are so many episodes that are fantastic, but that are, 60 minutes long, and the ideas in them could easily be a feature movie. And so I think what he would want to do is to expand a concept from one of the original series or one of the Next Generation episodes, and take that to its like feature length thing. So that might be what he's doing here. We don't really know. We don't even know if this will involve the cast of the reboot series with Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto,
yeah,
all of them. If J.J. Abrams is involved, I'm guessing it probably would, but who knows? I mean, the original plan was for a potential Star Trek 4 to involve Kirk meeting his father through time travel shenanigans, and it would be Chris Hemsworth from Star Trek. Remember that?
Right. Yes.
And it seems like other, but pretty much the Star Trek franchise is kind of on the back burner right now in terms of feature films. This could be like the shot in the arm the franchise needs in terms of movies. I know the Star Trek Discovery TV show is going on right now, and it's supposed to be pretty good. I haven't seen any of it, but I'm hearing good things, and I don't know. I think I would be very excited for a Tarantino Star Trek movie if this comes to pass. I don't think it will end up being him directing it. I think our best case scenario is, like, 3 or 4 years from now, a Star Trek movie comes out, and Tarantino has like a story by credit while somebody else directed and wrote the movie.
Yeah, I think that's the most likely, because waiting till 2021 for the next Star Trek movie, it's already been, would it come out last year?
It was last year that Star Trek Beyond came out.
Star Trek Beyond, yeah. I mean, that's a long time. That's 5 years. Was it that long between Into Darkness and the other movies? I don't remember. I don't think
there
so.
There was about 4 years in between the original and Into Darkness.
Okay.
And then there was three years between Into Darkness and Beyond. Into Darkness and Beyond both kind of underperformed at the box office. So I don't think Paramount has Star Trek on its mind right now, unless Tarantino is making it. Because if you put Tarantino's name on something, like people will turn out for it,
That's
kind of the thing. And that's why I think they're allowing this movie to be rated R, is because, well, we've seen like Logan and Deadpool succeed in that arena. And if you put Tarantino's name on this, like, people are going to be curious enough to check this out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
But anyway, yeah, so that's Tarantino potentially making a Star Trek movie, which is fucking insane. And finally, we got one last bit of film news, Mike. The Golden Globe nominations were announced today. Did you see this at all?
I did not, actually.
I didn't think you did.
Come on. Who do you think I am? A person that prepares?
Yeah, no, we don't care about the Golden Globes that much. They are a ridiculous awards show. And as always, some ridiculous shenanigans happened during the Golden Globe nominations.
Tell me what's nominated as a musical this year.
I can tell you that Get Out is in that category. You
want all right. Yeah.
The musical or comedy category, Get Out. but anyway, yeah. So here are the nominees for Best Motion Picture Drama. It's Call Me By Your Name, Dunkirk, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. All of which, you know, sure. Those are all movies that deserve recognition, I think. I haven't gotten to see Call Me By Your Name, The Post, or The Shape of Water yet, but I'm very excited to get to. Yes. And then in Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy, The Disaster Artist, Get Out, I, Tonya, Lady Bird, and The Greatest Showman.
Holy shit.
AKA Hugh Jackman's circus musical, which is coming out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
This is a movie that people make fun of a lot just because it looks, you know, whatever. It was just kind of funny that, you know, it's like nobody is talking about this movie in terms of awards recognition. And I guess they threw a pretty good party for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association because they got nominated for a few awards.
Jesus Christ.
So that was kind of the biggest like, all right, Golden Globes, come on, Greatest Showman. But in addition, Hugh Jackman's also nominated for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy for Greatest Showman, as well as Ansel Elgort for Baby Driver in that category as well.
Really?
Which is kind of cool, but that's the only nomination for Baby Driver. And if you're only going to give Baby Driver one nomination, that is not the nomination that I would give Baby Driver at all. Ansel Elgort is good in Baby Driver, but there's so many other elements of that movie that outshine him so much. There are other actors in that movie that outshine him so much. You know, it seems odd that he would be the one that is recognized for Baby Driver. But yeah, anyway, for Best Performance in Drama Actor, Timothy Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name, Daniel Day-Lewis for Phantom Thread, Tom Hanks The Post, Gary Oldman Darkest Hour, Denzel Washington for Roman J. Israel Esquire. And then Best Actress, Jessica Chastain, Molly's Game, Sally Hawkins, The Shape of Water, Frances McDormand, Three Billboards, Meryl Streep, The Post, Michelle Williams, All the Money in the World. And, actually, this is the best part. Christopher Plummer is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for All the Money in the World.
That's fucking amazing.
A role that he shot, a week ago.
Yeah, he just finished right this morning, yeah. Actually.
And I feel
it's incredible.
Yeah, and All the Money in the World is nominated for a few awards here, and I think part of that is because the Golden Globes wanted to brag that they've seen it. I'm pretty sure they're the only ones who have. This movie must have just finished. So it's weird that it is nominated for as many awards as it is, and that it's hilarious that Christopher Plummer is in this category. It's just pretty funny.
That seems like a big middle finger.
Yeah, it does definitely.
That's awesome.
And Ridley Scott's actually nominated for Best Director as well for All the Money in the World. The other Best Director nominees, Guillermo del Toro, The Shape of Water, Martin McDonagh for Three Billboards, Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, and Steven Spielberg for The Post. So I think there are a lot of good nominees here, and then there's just weird ones. All the Money in the World's nominated for a bunch. The Greatest Showman's nominated for a bunch. And then there are a bunch of snubs, for example. Obviously, Golden Globes also has their TV categories.
Mm-hmm.
Twin Peaks only has one nomination, and it's one it absolutely deserves. It's Kyle MacLachlan for Best Actor in a Miniseries.
Okay.
Which, you know, absolutely, that's the performance of the decade for me. So he, not only should he be nominated, he should win, and nobody else should win for the next several years. It's just out of respect for his. But that signals to me that that Twin Peaks was eligible for all these miniseries awards,
right?
And not nominated for Best Miniseries or TV Film. Instead, there's a Big Little Lies, Fargo, Feud, The Sinner, and Top of the Lake, China Girl. And to me, it's you're going to nominate Feud over Twin Peaks. Are you kidding me?
How dare you?
Where do you get off? And then in the TV series categories, for drama, there's The Crown, Game of Thrones, The Handmaid's Tale, Stranger Things, and This Is Us, and the musical or comedy, Blackish, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Master of None, Smilf, and, Will and Grace. Smilf is a Showtime comedy. Which nobody's heard of, but it's there anyway. And Will and Grace, sure.
Sure, why not?
Also, No Good Place, which is very upsetting. But, I don't know. I'm just giving you a cursory glance at these nominations, Mike, but what do you think?
It seems pretty, of course. It's all of these things all the time, all every time, every year. Like, most, you know, I did see one reaction that was Lady Bird, right? That's Greta Gerwig's movie has the record for the best fucking Rotten Tomatoes score of all time ever, basically, I think. Patty Jenkins and Wonder Woman, you know, one of the most important movies of the year. Pointing out there's all these incredible movies made by female directors, and it's just five dudes. What are you doing? Golden Globes, come on.
I mean, Greta Gerwig should probably be nominated as a director, I think, of the female directors. I mean, there is a lot who should be recognized. Sofia Coppola had The Beguiled this year. Dee Rees, who directed Mudbound, which I just watched on Netflix, was a really good movie. I forget the woman's name, but the person who directed Raw. Did you see Raw?
No, but I remember you telling me all about it.
Yeah, it is great. And she did a phenomenal job. That's probably, like, of the movies that I've seen directed by female directors this year, which, you know, just by virtue of the fact that so many more are directed by men, there hasn't been that many that have. I think I've seen like 8 or 9 directed by women. I think Raw is easily the best of the ones that I've seen. Raw is not a movie that would get recognized at the Golden Globes, but like
no,
but like it totally should be. But I mean, the directors they do have here, like they're all. I think you could probably get rid of Ridley Scott. I haven't seen all the money in the world, and I love Ridley Scott, but like I'm guessing you can probably get rid of Ridley Scott on this one. This one. So those are the Golden Globe nominations. Just wanted to bring those up. I think the ceremony is the beginning of January, January 7th, hosted by Seth Meyers, which should be good. Should be a good time.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think that about wraps up our film news, Mike, and we should move on into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time to move on into our discussions here on Film Bookcast. And Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
I actually have a few movies to discuss this week.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I recently signed up for Filmstruck, which is the Criterion Collection and Turner Classic Movies streaming service.
Yes.
And they have a pretty banging selection of movies, Mike. If those names didn't tickle your cinephile fancy, I don't know what will.
You made a motion like it was tickling my balls.
It could be both. It could be one and the same.
That is where the cinephile fancy is located, so you're not wrong. But
anatomically speaking, you're correct.
I've wanted to sign up for Filmstruck for a while now, but it doesn't have a PlayStation 4 platform yet, so I've held off. But I'm glad that you've been able to test it out. So how is it?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The actual website platform could use a little work. It's you know, it leaves a little bit to be desired in terms of actual functionality. Like, well, that sounds harsher than I thought it meant. It's just the catalog is only listed in alphabetical order, so you have to scroll through every movie, which, like, hey, I got to pick out some movies I would have never picked to watch before. So that's awesome. But so the three movies that I have watched so far, first one is Tokyo Drifter from 1966, directed by Seijun Suzuki. And this is a like mid-60s Japanese gangster film. It's really fluorescent and jazzy. And it's this story of a Japanese hood whose gang disbanded. And it's, you know, the classic, he's trying to go straight. He wants to be legit and he just keeps getting pulled back in. And it's a lot of fun. It's just like him being the main character. I think his name is Tetsu or something like that. Is just, you know, the best gangster that there ever has been, like the most deadly, you know, gangster in Tokyo. And it's just him fighting his way to being a legitimate human. And it's kind of awesome. It's just it's a quick hour and 20 minutes. And it's got an awesome like jazz soundtrack, and it's really, you know, colorful and bright and weird in the best kind of 60s Japanese way, I guess.
Nice.
My next movie is Lone Wolf and Cub 3,
ooh,
Baby Cart to Hades, which all is right, the best name of anything ever.
Now, we watched Shogun Assassin a couple of months ago.
Yes.
As part of the Hudson Horror Show. We weren't supposed to reveal that.
Yeah, you blew it, Mike. We'll have to beep that out in post.
Well, it's kind of relevant. Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. Yeah.
I think the statute of limitations has run out on that, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
I think so.
And besides, Hudson Horror Show is probably ending soon anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, Shogun Assassin we watched a couple months ago, which is the English language dub that kind of edits together the first two Lone Wolf and Cub movies.
Yes.
But there are six of them in total, and I've only seen Shogun Assassin. So you watched Lone Wolf and Cub 3. Skipping over the Japanese dub of 1 and 2 because you figured, like, you've already seen them, sort of.
I feel like I've seen the edit of both of them together. I've probably got most of it. And basically, watching the third one kind of confirms what I think, is that they're probably all the same type of thing. It's just, if you don't know Lone Wolf and Cub, the premise is the main character is an older man, with his son, and he was a executioner for the Shogun dynasty or whatever it is. And he, I can't remember exactly why, what happens in Shogun Assassin that he ends up like on the run, if he's just put exiled or whatever happens. I don't remember. But it's just him and his son traveling the Japanese countryside. And it's kind of reminiscent of Tokyo Drifter. He's just trying to survive, just trying to go, be legitimate. And he's just all relentlessly pursued by samurai and ninja and just all of this stuff. And it's from 1972. So it's got the glorious, katana strike and just fountain, like absolute fountain of blood. And just everyone is, it's like a Tarantino movie, like right. Kill Bill. It's like, that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which I think it's even, they watch Shogun Assassin, right? In Kill Bill.
They do. Yeah. At the end of Kill Bill Volume 2, the bride watches it with her daughter.
Yeah, and it's fucking awesome. So Lone Wolf and Cub 3, Baby Cart to Hades. I just wanted to reiterate that. Best title ever. and it's just a lot of fun. It's big, silly samurai fun. And that's also a huge plus for Filmstruck, a huge bonus. Tons of samurai movies. So,
that's
like,
great.
I'm like kind of really on a samurai kick right now, and it's a lot of fun.
Nice.
And the third movie I watched is The Long Goodbye.
He's a real cutie pie, Lieutenant.
Yeah, how
do you spell? He's a smart ass, that's what he is.
That's what I meant.
And why don't you learn to say what you mean?
He's a real smart ass, Lieutenant.
Which, now for something completely different. Long Goodbye from 1973, directed by Robert Altman, starring Elliot Gould. And this is a retelling, or I don't know if there was ever another movie of The Long Goodbye, but it's a Raymond Chandler novel, Philip Marlowe character, classic, probably the classic detective, hard-boiled.
Yeah, Philip Marlowe was the subject of so many movies in the 40s and stuff, and then that kind of died down, but then Long Goodbye was in the 70s.
Yes, yeah, and it's a really interesting take on Philip Marlowe in Long Goodbye. He's the kind of, like I said, the most classic. He's the archetypal Humphrey Bogart, cool, suave-talking, quick-witted detective, hard, knight in shining armor, only person with morals in the dirty Los Angeles. And in Long Goodbye, he's just like a chain smoking, bumbling, like he's just a rube, and it's like the best thing ever. Elliot Gould is like just talking to himself under his breath the whole movie, pretty much. And it features a classic jilted lover, but it's actually a secret pact with the whole, Marlowe ends up lost in this web that he cannot navigate ever. And it's awesome. It's a lot of fun. So that's Filmstruck, I guess. And also these three movies. Oh, the really cool thing also about Filmstruck is that since it is the Criterion stuff, they include special features in the streaming service.
Oh,
so
really?
Like I watched like a little 7-minute video essay on The Long Goodbye afterwards.
Nice.
It's like got a lot of cool stuff like that.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
And your boy, what's his name? Ben Mankiewicz is in there a lot too.
I bet he is. Yeah.
Yeah. The Turner Classic guy.
Doing the intros and stuff. That's right.
Yeah.
That's cool. I've been meaning to get Filmstruck for a while, and I'm glad that you, I'm glad that you have it to class up the podcast a little bit, Mike, with discussions of classic cinema.
You're welcome. I did it for you, everyone.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I watch like a lot of movies too, and I watch a lot of classic movies, on the regular, but, since I watch so many of them, I usually cater my discussions to whatever the more recent stuff is. I like talking about older stuff too. So maybe we should, maybe we should rework discussions into more like, into just be everything.
Ooh.
But then, the podcast will be like 3 hours long. So we'll have to, let's like workshop it, work around it.
Colin, we'll have to start doing hand workouts to be able to keep up with us for the minutes. Oh, fun fact I wanted to point out. In The Long Goodbye, there's a scene where Marlo ends up at the kind of like gangster boss's headquarters where he's joined with all of his muscle.
Yeah.
In an uncredited, lineless role, Arnold Schwarzenegger hanging out.
Yeah, he
just
is.
Chilling in the background without a shirt on for a while. It's great.
Yeah, that's pretty great. What's great is it's like 4 years after, I think, Hercules in New York. So he was already like kind of a star at that point. But he's just there for no reason. Like, he's just in the background of that movie for no reason.
He's just a big, muscly dude, so he's in it.
Anyway, I've got a few things I wanted to talk about in my discussions as well. The first is The Lost City of Z, which is the new movie from director James Gray, who directed this movie called The Immigrant a couple of years ago with Joaquin Phoenix and Marion Cotillard, which was fantastic. And this stars Charlie Hunnam, Sienna Miller, Robert Pattinson, and Tom Holland. They're all in this movie. And it details a British explorer in the early 1900s and his repeated trips to find a lost city in South America. And it's just a visually lovely movie. It's sometimes very thrilling. It is very deliberately paced. And so I think the movie's nearly 2.5 hours long. I think if it was like 2 hours, it moved a little quicker. I think I might have liked it a little bit more, but then I also think it might have lost some of the lushness almost. It feels like the kind of like big, just kind of studio epic that you don't see that much anymore, like in the vein of something like Lawrence of Arabia.
Something by Cecil B. DeMille or some shit.
Yeah, obviously not on the same caliber of Lawrence of Arabia or even of the same visual level. But I think The Lost City of Z is in that same kind of ilk. You know, it has this kind of sense of exploration that I think is really engaging and fun. And it's worth checking out. It's available on Amazon Prime. It's actually an Amazon original. So you're able to find it there. I also watched Girls Trip this past week, which is the new comedy movie. Have you heard of Girls Trip, Mike?
Yeah, I think I have. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what I think it is, but
it came out this past summer, and it was kind of like the breakout comedy hit of the summer. It starred Regina Hall, Queen Latifah, Jada Pinkett Smith, and Tiffany Haddish. And you know, this movie was kind of not really on my radar at all for a long time, and then suddenly it started to make a lot of money. I think it broke $100 million at the box office, which for a comedy that stars four African-American women is kind of insane.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. And so this movie was a pretty big hit, and people really wanted to see it, so I wanted to check it out. And it's good. I mean, I think it's a really, really funny movie. It does get bogged down with the drama stuff towards the end. It kind of has the problem that a lot of modern comedies have, where it tries to be like all heartfelt and sincere, and at the expense of like the jokes, you know, which is kind of a bummer. But for the most part, this is a really funny movie. Terrific cast, just bouncing off of each other, and Tiffany Haddish in particular. Just pops. Like, she is incredible in this movie. Every scene she has is like gut busting. This is like a Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover or Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids level of like breakout performance.
Just grapefruit them.
What?
Yeah, I ain't never grapefruited before.
No. But I'm listening.
What you want to do is you get a grapefruit, right?
Okay.
And you cut both ends off as so. Then you cut a hole in the middle, like this, like a nice little tunnel. And then you place that on his penis, like this.
Oh.
Okay? Like that.
Oh.
Right? Now you want to squeeze and twist and suck, so then it feels like he's getting fucked and sucked all at the same time. It's like this. Show just a little bit, because that make him feel like a man, like he killing your shit. Dude, this is tickling my throat. Now, you never, ever want to do this with a pineapple. I almost died.
Very eager to see more stuff from Tiffany Haddish in the future. And also Jada Pinkett Smith is great in this movie too. I wanted to give a shout out to her, because I feel like most of the focus has been on Haddish, but I think Jada Pinkett Smith is really, really good. Also, Luke Cage is in this. Mike Coulter is in this too, so that's kind of neat.
Nice.
Too. Anyway, so that's Girls Trip. And then I have a few other things that I wanted to talk about. I went to the Lethal Weapon Marathon this past weekend at the Alamo Draft House in Yonkers, and that was pretty dope.
I'm too old for this shit.
was cool. It was all four Lethal Weapon movies back to back at the Draft House. Didn't have as much of a turnout as some of the other marathons I've been to. The theater was only about half full for this one, which was kind of a bummer. But, you know, I was still pretty excited for it. And, you know, the first Lethal Weapon is still, you know, I think one of the better action movies of the 80s. And it's, you know, it's the first indication of Shane Black, but he wrote the screenplay for the first movie. And it's just, it's so much fun. You know, I like the franchise as a whole, but I think the first movie is easily the best because it is a much darker movie than the franchise would become. You know, it really gets into Riggs's suicidal tendencies, which are part of Lethal Weapon 2 as well, which Shane Black originally wrote, and then it was rewritten by somebody else. Because at the end of Lethal Weapon 2, Shane Black was going to have Riggs die, like actually die. And the studio put the kibosh on that and said, no, we have to make more movies. But then, you know, then the series gets like progressively goofier as it goes on. You know, you add Joe Pesci in starting at Lethal Weapon 2. Rene Russo comes in and Lethal Weapon 3, and Chris Rock comes in and Lethal Weapon 4. But what I kind of like about them is they do kind of build into like, by the end of Lethal Weapon 4, like, it feels like you've been on a journey with these characters. Like, it's a much more character-based franchise than I think a lot of other action franchises of its ilk. And so you have these characters, like, kind of growing over time. And, like, you know, Lethal Weapon 3 adds Rene Russo, who begins a relationship with Mel Gibson's character, Riggs. And they, you know, like, you follow them having their baby in Lethal Weapon 4. And so you see the cast growing bigger and bigger, and the family kind of growing bigger and bigger. And you grow attached to these characters. And it's nice. And the action gets more and more insane, which helps. Because Lethal Weapon 3 and 4, I don't think are great, but they are a lot of fun to watch, I think. Like, they're just really enjoyable. Also, Jet Li is in Lethal Weapon 4. And
what?
Yeah. Have you seen any of the Lethal Weapons, Mike?
Yeah, I've definitely seen 1 and 2, and 3 and 4 I have probably seen, but in my memory, they're those movies that I have only seen, like, the TNT edit of. Gotcha. I don't think I've ever seen the actual, like, theatrical cut.
Yeah, no, Jet Li makes his American debut in Lethal Weapon 4. He's the villain, and he's incredible. Like,
that's
like,
awesome.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of, like, yeah, and it's actually kind of funny, because, you know, he's in, like, hand-to-hand combat situations with Gibson and Danny Glover, and and it's very clear who should be winning these fights.
Yeah, yeah.
And he mostly does for most of the movie, and then at the end, like, Gibson, like, overpowers him, and it's like, I don't believe this.
Come on, wait a second.
But yeah, anyway, I just wanted to give a shout out to the Lethal Weapon Marathon, because it's a lot of fun. You know, I wanted to give a shout. If you haven't seen the Lethal Weapons in a while, I would recommend them. They're good stuff. And I also wanted to give a shout out to Crisis on Earth X. Now, Mike, you asked me what this was when I mentioned that I was talking about this.
Yeah.
So to refresh your memory, this is the year's big crossover between the DC TV shows on the CW. So that's Supergirl, Arrow, The Flash, and Legends of Tomorrow.
Why would Nazis from 1945 want to crash my wedding?
Crab legs. They're delicious.
Visitors from another Earth?
Oh, there are more than one?
There are 52, actually.
There's a 53rd Earth. And it's called Earth X.
Velvet Dream.
They want someone to bow to worship, to lead.
What you're doing is not leading. It's ruling.
Ready? Aim. Kill them all!
And, you know, with last year's crossover, which was called Invasion, you know, that one I thought was okay. And it was, you know, kind of a traditional TV crossover. Like, they did, like, an episode of Supergirl, and at the end of Supergirl, two characters came in and were like, we gotta go stop this thing. And then they brought her into another show. And so, that next they did an episode of The Flash where they were fighting all, like, they brought together all the shows and they were fighting aliens. Then they kind of did, like, a bottle episode of Arrow, which was related to the crossover, but not really. And, like, it was kind of weird. And then Legends of Tomorrow was kind of, like, the big finale. But it felt very episodic, and it felt very kind of disconnected and loose. And this year, they went all out to make this, like, a movie level event. This is a 4-hour movie with
that's fucking,
like,
awesome,
using all these TV shows. So they even got rid of, like, the title sequences from all the shows and whatever. So it doesn't say, like, this is an episode of Supergirl, this is an episode of Arrow. It just starts off with Crisis on Earth X. And that's it.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And so it was a 2-night event. The first night was Supergirl and Arrow. The second night was The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow. And this was just truly spectacular. If you don't know the plot of this this movie, I guess I should call it, The Flash is getting married on the Flash TV show. So you know, the wedding is coming up. So it's the day of the wedding, and all the different superheroes and all the different characters from all the other shows are coming over, and, you know, to celebrate The Flash's wedding. And then The Flash's wedding gets crashed by Nazis from another Earth.
That's the most comic books thing ever, and it's so funny every time you say it.
Yeah, so Nazis from Earth X cross over into our Earth to try to take over our Earth. And the Nazis from Earth X are doppelganger versions of the heroes from our shows. So there's like a Nazi Supergirl and a Nazi Green Arrow who are the Nazi Green Arrow is actually the Fuhrer of the land. And this was like, it's just such an insane premise. And it's so like ridiculous, but awesome. And the action was just next level. They went all out on this thing. And there's so many character beats that feel like earned and make sense. This is everything Justice League should have been. Like,
yeah.
and it feels very sad. It's just very satisfying. The CW shows had never strayed away from, tackling, real world topics head on, especially Supergirl, to that extent. And they're never subtle about it. Like, they're pretty on the nose with everything they do. Like the finale of Supergirl last year was called Nevertheless, She Persisted.
that's pretty rad though.
Yeah. And they frequently make references to like Donald Trump's wall and stuff like that. It was actually just a couple episodes ago. Because Supergirl deals a lot with, aliens on their planet, like literal aliens. And they use that as a metaphor for aliens in the real world. And so there's a lot of stuff like that. And so this kind of takes all the Nazi stuff that has been in the news over the past year, and it's so fucking cathartic to watch superheroes of these particular superheroes just beating the shit out of Nazis. because what these CW shows have also done is make these shows so diverse and so inclusive on every level. So there are several Jewish characters, there are several Black characters, several gay characters on all of these shows. And all of them are, you know, major superheroes and stuff like that. And so to have these characters punching the shit out of Nazis is just so much fun to watch. And highly recommended Crisis on Earth X. I don't think you even need to have watched the shows. If you just wanted to watch this special, it definitely helps because it does like, you know, build on story beats from all the different shows. So if you watch all four shows, you'll get the most out of it. But if you don't, I think you can just jump in on this for a fun superhero adventure and you would enjoy it.
I might do that as a discussion next week.
It's worth checking out. I don't know how you can watch it right now. You might be able to watch it on demand. Like if you go to the individual shows, the order is Supergirl, Arrow, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow. If you need help,
okay.
But it'll say in the description like part one or part two or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think it's going to be a nightmare for people who are binge watching like one show at a time.
I'm plowing through Supergirl and I only get part three, like or whatever.
Yeah. So anyway, that is Crisis on Earth X. Well worth checking out if you love superheroes. Like I said on Twitter that the three best superhero movies this year are Logan, the Lego Batman movie, and Crisis on Earth X. And
yeah,
and I'm only like half joking about that. So worth checking out. Anyway. Other than that, I have one last thing I want to talk about, Mike, and this is actually a book. I don't read so much anymore, Mike, but when I do, I like to talk about it on my discussions. And when I do read, it's about Twin Peaks.
yeah, all that tracks.
Yeah. So, Twin Peaks, The Final Dossier, written by Mark Frost, came out, probably like 2 months ago, and I recently got it. And, essentially it's kind of works as a companion piece to, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, which is the book that he wrote last year, which came out before, season three as kind of the lead into that. And this kind of acts as like the epilogue to season three in a lot of ways. It's a great addendum to Twin Peaks, The Return. It actually goes into detail and fills in so many of the blanks between, that were left between the original series and this new one. And it also answers some questions that, The Return left hanging. So if you're somebody who's interested in the mythology of Twin Peaks, this is a must get. So if you want those questions answered, be warned. You're going to have more questions.
Yeah, that's pretty Twin Peaks, though.
Yeah, after you get those answers. But well worth checking out. And if you're interested in the fates of people like Audrey, who, you know, people are very confused about what happened to her. Annie from the original series. So many characters. Philip Jeffries. There's a lot about Philip Jeffries in this book. So well worth checking out if you are a fan of Twin Peaks in any shape or form, as I know I am. I actually was... I was on Twitter today, and one of my favorite critics, Alan Sepinwall, tweeted his best of TV list, and Twin Peaks was on it, and included was a clip from Twin Peaks. It was the opening scene of the first episode of Twin Peaks: The Return, and it was like 2 minutes long, and I watched it, and I was just like transfixed all over again, and I was at work. I was just like sitting at my computer at work watching this Twin Peaks clip.
Remember 430. richer than Linda. To our certain stone.
I understand.
And when it ended, like I kind of like snapped out of a daze or whatever. It was but luckily, I just purchased Twin Peaks: The Return on Blu-ray, and I will be rewatching it again very, very soon. Anyway, Mike, I think that about wraps up our discussions. We got to move on. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Let's move on into our review of The Disaster Artist.
Los Angeles, everybody wants to be star. You have to be the best and never give up.
When I get up on stage in front of people, all I can think about is, what if they laugh at me? But you, man, you're fearless.
No.
I want to feel that too.
I don't care. I'll do it. No. You and me, we both have this dream.
Yeah, I guess we do.
That we'll be famous. We'll show them. Watch out, here we go. To be or not to be.
It's not going to happen for you. Not in a million years.
But after that? This town, Greg. They don't want me.
Wish we could just make our own movie.
A great idea.
All right, that was from the trailer for The Disaster Artist, a new movie written by Scott Neustadter and Michael H. Weber and directed by James Franco. It stars James Franco, Dave Franco, Seth Rogen, Alison Brie, Ari Grainer, Josh Hutcherson, Jackie Weaver, and just about every recognizable face in modern comedy.
It's basically How Did This Get Made, the movie.
Yeah. All three podcast members of How Did This Get Made are in this movie, actually, which is pretty wild. Yeah. And the IMDb plot synopsis for The Disaster Artist reads, when Greg Sestero, an aspiring film actor, meets the weird and mysterious Tommy Wiseau in an acting class, they form a unique friendship and travel to Hollywood to make their dreams come true. Now, Mike, The Room is a movie I've known about since about high school, I would say. So going on 8 or 9 years now. And it's one that my friends and I used to joke about, right, and quote all the time. Like you mentioned that you have like this a certain relationship with The Room. Like, what were you gonna say?
Yeah. So I had this friend Steph my freshman year of college, who we were both. She was in, I think it was like a European cinema class, and I was in an independent cinema class, I think, where we both were like, hey, let's watch all these movies together. We would, you know, try and one up each other with whatever weird fucking movie we were watching.
Yeah.
And she punked me so hard, where she was like, oh my God, I just found out about this movie, The Room. My friends from home showed me it. It's incredible. We have to watch it. And I was like, all right, I'm in.
Oh,
like,
man.
We just watched Breathless. Let's watch The Room. like that kind of – like it was this level punk.
Yeah.
So then we sat down and watched The Room, and I just looked at her afterwards, and I was like, what the fuck? And she lost her mind, and like she got me – like she tricked me into watching The Room.
That's
I was so bad. so that was my entry into the – I was punked into watching The Room.
That's amazing. So you weren't laughing throughout The Room. It was after it ended that you were like
– Yeah, like because I didn't – was like my friend really likes this movie. Like I don't – like I feel weird laughing at – like I didn't know what was going on. but then like yeah, it was great. Okay. It was – we have like it's since – you know, I'm in on the joke now.
That's good.
Yes.
That's good. So you were like the people watching The Room for the first time in the theater at the end of the movie, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
I've known about The Room since I think my senior year of high school. Like it's been a long time. My friend told me about it then, and we watched it together, and it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. We laughed at it and stuff like that. When I heard James Franco was making his own movie about the making of The Room, I was kind of two minds about it, you know, because I think the problem is that everyone makes fun of The Room. Like, that's,
yeah.
Like, you know, go to any bad movie riffing channel on YouTube or whatever, and I guarantee you they have a The Room episode. Like, you know, yeah. Nostalgia Critic did one. How Did This Get Made? CinemaSins, Riff Tracks. It has been done. Like, what else is there left to say? And then there's also the question of how many people would actually be interested in this, because outside of, like, cult movie fans, are there that many people who know what The Room even is? Like...
I had a very hilarious experience to this point afterwards. My parents and I went to the movies on Sunday morning. They went to see Roman J. Esquire or whatever that movie is.
Yeah.
I went to see The Room. We met up – or Disaster Artist, sorry. We met up afterwards and we were talking about the movies we saw, and my mom was like – yeah, I mean, like, what's – like, I know Brie Larson won the Oscar for it, and like, I, like, what's that – and like, that is my – what I assume – which is, of course, just Room, I think, is the title of that movie. Yeah. So, like, I assume that's got to be, like, the general audience reaction if you don't know what The Room is. You think this is a movie about the making of an Oscar-winning movie.
I'm glad you told that story, because I also had the same story where I was talking to somebody about it the other day, and they thought I was talking about the movie Room with Brie Larson and Jacob Tremblay.
That's amazing.
So, like, outside of, like, really, like, hardcore movie geeks, like, you know, people who are on the internet a lot or whatever, like, they're, you know, like, the mainstream doesn't really know what The Room is, I don't think. And even then, you know, James Franco has directed something like 16 other movies, none of which anybody has ever seen. Like, most of which are stuff that nobody has ever seen, and by all accounts are, like, basically student films with famous people in them. Is kind of what they are. So, like, why should The Disaster Artist have been any different? You know, like, why should this be the movie that escapes that? And all that is to say, I think this movie had a lot going against it, and against all odds. Like, it's kind of a miracle that it exists, and it is as good as it is, because, you know, it's kind of like The Room in that way, I guess.
I honestly was kind of really afraid going in, because, one, like you said, this has been done, but, like, this idea of making fun of The Room is dead at this point, right? It's unoriginal. But I was also really afraid that it was just going to be really, like, ruthless and mean about what is going on. Like, not that I don't feel protective of The Room or Tommy Wiseau by any stretch. But I'm not sure how down I am to watch 2 hours of people making fun of other people.
that would feel like punching down almost. Like, you're James Franco, you're the successful Hollywood actor. You're just gonna, you know, do this entire project just to make fun of this guy who made a bad movie.
And that's what I thought was gonna happen. And I was very pleasantly surprised that it's pretty much the opposite of that. It's like an exaltation of Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So, Mike, what were your overall thoughts on The Room? Or on The Disaster Artist, I mean.
Well, okay, so about The Room. No. I had a lot of fun with this. Like I said, I was really nervous that I thought it was going to be mean, and it's not. It's just like a straight up like biopic version of how The Room got made. And it, of course, is silly and pokes fun at everything that is Tommy Wiseau and that whole situation.
Yeah,
he's from New Orleans, and he's just as old as you are, no matter who asks. But that said, like, it's got some pretty incredible performances. James Franco as Tommy Wiseau is, like, just a sight to behold. Yeah. And, like, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Like, it's kind of scary. The other Franco, Dave Franco, sure, he's cool, I guess. But I did actually have a ton of fun, like, playing the "oh, it's that guy" game with every other character, every other actor in this movie. Yeah,
everybody in this movie is a recognizable face.
Yeah, Nathan Fielder, I think, is his name. That was probably my favorite.
Is that your favorite? My favorite was Josh Hutcherson as Denny.
Oh my god! Yeah, that's fair.
But anyway, I think what makes this movie succeed is that Franco's not really making fun of Tommy Wiseau in The Room. Like, he is a little bit, but that's definitely a factor. But, like, instead, he is crafting, like, a really sincere story about artists working to make something, and that thing taking a life of its own beyond what the filmmakers, like, perhaps intended, but still something that struck a chord with people. It kind of reminded me of The Social Network in that way, where it's, like, you know, just kind of this very sincere story. Like, it's about Facebook, but it's not really about Facebook. It's about something else. Right. It's about these characters. But it is essentially an updated version of Tim Burton's Ed Wood, which is the real movie that I wanted to draw a comparison to, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. And for the most part, I think it really succeeds. You know, this movie is very funny. It's got a lot of heart, terrific cast. And by the end, I think it makes itself feel like an essential companion piece to The Room. Like, from now on, I don't think anybody will discuss one movie without the other one. They are one movie, in my mind, almost. Like, if you've seen The Room, you have to see The Disaster Artist. And if you've seen The Disaster Artist, you have to have seen The Room.
Yeah, I definitely had that thought where I wondered, or have seen people online also asking this question, can you see The Disaster Artist without knowing anything about The Room? And I guess you could, right? Like, it sets up and explains enough of it that it could stand alone. But it would feel like you're missing out on the joke, even though the movie's not a joke, like we kind of talked about.
Right. I do think if you're unfamiliar with The Room, the movie might lose some impact, right? Unlike Ed Wood, which I saw before I had seen any Ed Wood movies, but that didn't matter because that was so character-driven, and so, like, it wasn't just focused on one movie, it was focused on several.
Yeah.
Here, much of the movie is just on the set of The Room, like, and a lot of it is recreating scenes in The Room, and I'm not sure an audience member would find them funny unless they already knew the scene that was being recreated, that's, you know?
That's true, yeah. Yeah, I definitely did have that feeling, though, that we I was more interested in the making of the room, like the actual, like, on-set stuff, that we do spend, you know, probably two acts of the movie just with Greg and Tommy, as you know. So I was like a little kind of, I wish we had seen more of the other just clusterfuck of just whatever they were trying to do, because it was so much fun. Like,
yeah.
And not even in the like, ah, this is, you know, making fun of this stuff, but just like the insanity and bizarreness of what they were doing, like filming on film and digital simultaneously for no reason.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, what? That's, why? What?
Yeah, no, so many things like that. Like, they would build, you know, a set that looks identical to the alleyway outside the set. Like,
yeah.
You know, because, and they could just film in the alleyway, but no, it's they have to build the set because it's a real Hollywood movie.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then because of that, they have to do a green screen, which looks terrible in the room. Yeah. But yeah, James Franco, just next level great as Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah.
I think it is maybe his best performance. And I was like pretty wary about it when he first shows up. When he first shows up, I think it feels like he's just doing an impression of Tommy Wiseau. Like it's kind of what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
And anybody can do an impression of Tommy Wiseau. You know, I just did one at the beginning of this podcast and,
yeah,
you know, it sounded spot on. But
he crushed it.
But I think he very quickly makes the character feel like his own. Less like he's doing an impression of Wiseau and more like Wiseau is a fictional character that James Franco is embodying almost. And I think Dave Franco does good work too as a Greg Sestero, and he kind of ably sells this kind of just nervous guy swept up into Tommy's world almost, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But a lot of the pleasure of this movie is seeing famous people as cast members of The Room. And for me, Josh Hutcherson was the highlight as Denny, as you mentioned, Nathan Fielder, is whatever the guy's name. He's like their nerdy friend or whatever.
The psychologist guy.
Ari Grainer is also really good as Lisa, and Jackie Weaver as Lisa's mother, as the I definitely have breast cancer line is always, yeah, good. I do think the movie overall is like a little too reverent of The Room and of Tommy Wiseau. It's kind of in love with the idea of Tommy Wiseau's mystique.
Yeah.
And the fact that he made this movie out of nothing. But it kind of glosses over, I think, some of the shittier stuff that he does throughout the movie. And the misogynist subtext that is present in The Room is just like,
yeah,
never addressed in this movie at all.
Well, yeah, nothing explicit. We do have that whole like sex scene meltdown,
yeah,
scene,
that's
I guess.
That's kind of what I'm referring to in the shittier stuff that he does throughout the making of the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll talk about that in spoilers. Like, it's based on real life, but still spoilers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think by the end of the movie, it kind of glosses over that, you know, like that to me seemed like an irredeemable moment for Tommy Wiseau.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, you're right. It definitely ends on a, what'd you say? Reverent? That's a pretty good,
yeah,
a good way to,
or
to
a
put
triumphant
it.
Word, I guess.
Triumphant. Yeah. It ends on a pretty up note. Maybe not so much. maybe tone it back a little bit.
Yeah. But I do think overall this is a really good movie,
yeah.
And it's also a movie that only Franco I think really could have made. I think I was thinking about this, and like Franco has spent his entire career like yearning to get into like weirder and more experimental stuff, right? You know, it's why, mm-hmm, he does literally everything. It's why he's directed 16 movies that no one saw. It's why he did 20 episodes of General Hospital. You know, he was in that. He appears in Spring Breakers as like a totally bonkers role, and he hosted the Oscars because he will try anything. He wants to be a guy like Tommy Wiseau.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wiseau wants to be is a Hollywood actor cast in leading man roles like James Dean, or James Franco, who played James Dean in the
one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very weird situation, just all of this. Wiseau did the thing that Franco wishes he could. He made a really terrible, shitty movie that everyone loves. That is a triumph somehow still. I agree. It's a very weird, like, kind of meta, like, love letter thing going on with this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is that contrast that I think pushes the Disaster Artist over the top. It makes it something a lot more interesting than just like, what if we just made fun of The Room? Like, if anybody else made this movie, I don't think it would work like nearly as well, because Franco is such an odd presence in a lot of things. You know, it's almost like a joke at this point when Franco cameos in a movie or something like that. Remember, he was in Alien Covenant, and it was just like weird that James Franco was in Alien Covenant.
Yeah, like, I forgot about that.
Oh, hey, James Franco.
Oh, you're dead. All right, moving on. Yeah, no, it and it also is like this weird thing where there's kind of this running gag, I think, that James Franco just makes movies with his friends to hang out with his friends, right? Yeah. Like, you know, all the This Is the End and all that, whatever, all those movies,
all
Your Highness
stuff, yeah.
Yeah, like all that shit. I don't know why I picked Your Highness as the one to reference, but I did. But yeah, like that whole crew with, you know, Evan Goldberg and everybody. And he makes this movie, which is that. It's like we said, it's everyone that is, you know, the face of now modern comedy, and they, you know, all these podcasters and stuff that are also comedians and actors and stuff. But they make this movie, which could arguably also be The Room, right? Like, right. That's what it's, two friends making a movie by themselves just because they want to, you know, it's their dream, whatever. but I don't know. It's such an odd companion piece to the movie it's about, where this will be a great dramatic success, even though, you know, it just in terms of acting and everything that goes into this movie compared to The Room, just, and like,
right,
like it's just a, I don't know, it's a weird companion piece to this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you know, it's kind of amazing to me, like, the reaction this movie has gotten. Like, people, like, it's been getting really positive reviews all over the place. It's getting award nominations, like we just mentioned, it's nominated for best comedy or musical at the Golden mm-hmm. Globes, and there's a good chance, like, it goes to the Oscars, like there's a good chance,
yeah,
it ends up going there. And like, I think that's such a phenomenal ending to Tommy Wiseau's story. If Tommy Wiseau is invited to the Oscars because his, like, the movie about his movie is nominated for Best Picture, or something.
Yeah.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, I mean, that especially because there's that end title card or whatever you want to say there at the end of Disaster Artist, where Tommy Wiseau paid to keep The Room in a theater for 2 weeks in an effort to qualify for the Oscars.
Right.
And the Disaster Artist might get him there.
Yeah. Is there any other stuff you want to talk about, Mike, before we move on to spoilers?
No, I think there's some, we should talk about some specific things, and I guess they're spoilers.
All right, cool beans. Let's move on to spoilers for The Disaster Artist, starting right now.
Stop it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for The Disaster Artist, starting right now. So what I was referring to before is that, you know, Tommy Wiseau starts to go out of control on the set of The Room. He starts spying on his crew. He refuses to pay for water or air conditioning during a heat wave. And in one particularly egregious scene, he practically sexually assaults the actress who plays Lisa, played by Ari Grainer in this movie, when they're filming the sex scene in The Room. So he's just, like, wandering around the set completely naked. His wiener is, like, covered up with, like, a bag or something, like whatever.
A sock
yeah, or something. But yeah, and, you know, it's played for laughs a little bit. You know, he's like, I have to show my ass to sell this movie kind of thing. But everyone else on the set is, like, rightly horrified about what's going on, where he's, like, you know, jumping on top of Ari Grainer's character, and is trying to protect her during it. Like, Dave Franco as Greg is like, you know, are you uncomfortable? Like, you know, you can leave or whatever.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. So it's clear to me that, like, Franco and the filmmakers know that what Tommy is doing is bad.
Yeah.
But the result is that it feels a little weird when we're supposed to be rooting for Tommy again at the end of the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. You know, we have that scene of Paul Scheer, I think. Is that his name?
Paul Scheer? Like, how did it
succeed? Yeah.
Yes.
I forgot his name. You know, they almost start a fist fight. You know, he fires him and then unfire, like that whole thing. Yeah, so it's definitely an odd juxtaposition of just how fucking wrong what he's doing is versus, you know, and everyone's reaction versus the joke it's Tommy Wiseau's weird as he's, like, doing this. Yeah, and then, you know, we end on this kind of happy note about how him and Greg are still friends to this day, and they tour and talk every day, and this movie is seen by millions of people around the world, and, like, all this great stuff. Yeah, maybe don't mix those signals a little bit.
yeah, because it is, like, I think the movie does ultimately kind of, like, you know, portray Wiseau as sort of a villain, and that's kind of his arc, is, like, in the beginning of the movie, he's, like, yelling at the audience that they are the villains for laughing at him when he's acting and stuff like that. And then, you know, him kind of embodying the villain role throughout the making of the actual movie, The Room. But then it kind of, like, dials that back towards the end when it's time for The Room to become the bad movie masterpiece that we all know today. So it is a little weird on that front, I will say. But also I wanted to throw this out there. I wasn't really a fan of the Talking Heads portion at the beginning either, where it's just, like, famous people talking about The Room.
Yeah,
it felt very odd. It felt like I was about to watch a documentary.
About the room. I agree. I couldn't tell if that was like all just scripted joke stuff, because like, you know, Adam Scott has some funny shit that he says. But yeah, that definitely felt weird, and I kind of was ready to like it put me, like you said, it put me in documentary mode. And I thought that's what we were gonna do, just have this cast be the cast while we like of the movie, right? Because like I had heard, I had read that they shot, I think it was like 45 minutes or half an hour of the, like they just straight up remade the room, yeah, like shot for shot.
Which they show at the end of this movie. They show like side by side of the original room and like the recreated versions of the room.
Yeah. So like I thought we were going to get like a kind of documentary thing that just also featured like you know, dramatic recreation or whatever they call it in documentaries, but it's just going to be like James Franco and Dave Franco and Seth Rogen. But yeah, if that did feel weird, I guess, is that the long version of that answer is I agree.
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, it would be weird if like this movie ends up winning like an Oscar or something, and like people go like, oh, I'll watch this movie because it won an Oscar, and it's a movie that starts with like Kevin Smith in a hockey jersey talking about The Room. Like, I don't know, just very odd. But and same kind of goes for the end with the real footage of Wezzo. You know, I mean, I'm used to movies based on true stories doing that, so it's whatever. But yeah. I do think at some point we're going to find out where Wezzo's money came from, and the answer will not be good.
No, I like, we know he's a terrible human, right? Like, right. He's got to be.
He almost has to be. So he's probably I don't know where that money came from, but it cannot be a good answer. And I think this movie is a lot of fun right now. I think one day when we find out where Wezzo's money came from, we might look at this in a different light. But
yeah, I agree.
But anyway, otherwise, I did really enjoy just watching, you know, these famous people recreate scenes from The Room. I think just Josh Hutcherson as Denny. I love the scene where Denny just jumps in the bed with Tommy Wiseau and Lisa.
Denny, do you have something else to do?
I just like to watch you guys.
Oh, Denny boy.
Denny, two's great, but three is a crowd.
And he's like, I like to watch you guys. Like Josh Hutcherson being this like little kid. But one of my favorite lines in the movie was when Josh Hutcherson first shows up as Denny. And he's like trying to make sense of the character. It's like, wait, so how old is this character supposed to be? And like was always like, oh, same age as you, like 15, 16 years old. It's like, I'm 26. Like, yeah, look at the boy.
Yeah, it's super weird. And the Zac Efron thing at the premiere, bizarre.
Yeah,
super weird.
I genuinely had no idea that was Zac Efron playing Chris R at the beginning.
I'm pretty sure it's not. I think that's the joke.
Is it not? Oh, okay.
I don't think it is. I don't think so.
I would have to rewatch it. But I assumed there was like a lot of makeup or something on him to make him look that way. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's a different actor.
Maybe. I don't know.
But if it was actually Zac Efron at the beginning, I think I would have preferred if the movie didn't spell it out for us at the end, if it wasn't like, you know what I mean? Like if it was just like an extra thing, like, oh, hey, Zac Efron was, like, if you look at the credits, like, holy shit, that was Zac Efron. Like, I didn't need Zac Efron to just look like Zac Efron in the premiere and be like, oh, hey, I played Chris R.
I was Chris R, yeah.
But, yeah, otherwise, also, there's some pretty major cameos from Judd Apatow and Bryan Cranston. And the Bryan Cranston one in particular, I thought was kind of funny because they make a point to reference the fact that he's Malcolm in the Middle's Bryan Cranston and not Breaking Bad's.
Not Breaking Bad, yeah.
Because I had to remind myself, oh, these people haven't seen Breaking Bad yet. It's 2002. Like, yeah, it's super weird.
I did really like the little detail of the countdown clock of the shoot, and it's like day 67 of 40.
Yes.
It's like, yes, perfect.
Yeah, that was pretty great. Did you stick around for the after credit scene?
I did not. I saw there was one I left. I did not. It's bullshit. No, I missed it. I found out there was an after credit scene after I left the theater.
Okay, yeah, I actually had left the theater too. And I was talking about it with my friends outside the theater, and somebody like shouted to us, hey, you just came out of the Zester Artist? And we were like, yeah, there's an after credit scene playing right now. And we were like, oh shit. And we like ran inside. But the after credit scene is Tommy Wiseau himself, the actual guy, playing a character named Henry. And he finds Franco Wiseau at a party and he talks to him and he weirds him out. And that's kind of the thing. Like they have a conversation, and then like after that, Tommy, like real Tommy Wiseau leaves, and Franco Wiseau says like, what a weird guy. And that's kind of,
oh my God.
Yeah. And from what I read, they were actually contractually obligated, to include Wiseau in the movie somehow, in exchange for, the rights to use footage from The Room.
Holy shit.
Like that was a demand.
Yeah.
So they deliberately buried it at the end of the movie because they didn't want it to disrupt the flow of the,
of that's the
actual,
amazing.
Of the actual story. Apparently, Greg Sestero was supposed to have a scene in this movie too, but it was cut for time. But he was going to play a casting agent in Hollywood. Also, I didn't know this, but Greg Sestero has been an extra in a few other movies besides The Room.
Really?
Yeah, he was in Patch Adams with Robin Williams. He appears in a funeral scene, and he was in Accepted, the college comedy movie, which I love. He appears in the background of that movie.
Wow!
And he was in something else. He was in Gattaca. He was an extra in Gattaca as well.
What? Yeah. That's amazing.
But there's a video of on YouTube that shows clips of some of the movies he's appeared in as an extra in, and one of them says "Oh hi Mark" when he shows up. It's,
really?
Yeah, because it's somebody added in "Oh hi Mark." Like,
oh, I thought that was also the line in the movie that he's the extra in. I was like, oh my god, that's amazing.
I wish. Like, if you had Greg Sestero in your movie, how can you not say "Oh hi Mark" when he shows up?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Anyway, is there any other scenes in the movie that you want to talk about, Mike? Any other comedic bits that you wanted to bring up? Wazo dancing in the club was pretty funny.
I appreciated the touch of Greg handing Tommy the bottle, the empty water bottle. Yes. In the climactic I did not hit her scene. Just such a dumb touch. That's fucking hilarious.
Yeah, that was pretty great. And I love that was channeling all the lessons that Wazo had taught him as well. Sort of a teaching back and forth moment. It kind of it emphasizes their relationship and the fact that they're the only ones who really get each other in a weird way.
Yeah. Yes.
So, and yeah. I think it is kind of significant in that way that they're both played by Franco brothers too. Like they're both the Francos.
Yeah. That, I think that definitely lent a kind of authenticity to their weird fucking relationship, right, between Greg and Tommy, that they're just brothers acting off each other. I thought that was actually a really cool facet of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Otherwise, Mike, anything else, or should we wrap this up?
No, I think that's it. We kind of talked about everything.
All right, cool beans. We were both fans of The Disaster Artist. I think it does have some problems here and there, but it is a really funny movie, and it's worth checking out if you love The Room. If you love The Room, there's no reason for you not to see The Disaster Artist.
I really hope there's a Blu-ray edition of this that just has the half hour of The Room reshoot, the recreated Room on it.
I believe that is the plan.
Yes, that's fucking awesome. Because that's that 3-4 minutes or whatever at the end of the side by side split screen original and the reshot is hilarious.
Yeah, yes, yeah, it's worth checking out just to see these very funny people doing this incredibly ridiculous movie and doing it really well. Is pretty great. So worth checking out. Anyway, that about wraps up this week's episode of Film Bookcast. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You could find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you email about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, which will be happening next week, I believe, because we are talking a little movie. Maybe you heard of it. It's called Star Wars: The Last Jedi. It does feel like at this point it feels like the Star Wars movie feels like a reward at the end of a year kind of thing. That's sort of how I feel about them now. Is now they're coming out in December. We made it through a whole year, we get a Star Wars movie as a reward.
Yeah. Yeah, especially this year.
Yeah. this is the year where we need The Last Jedi.
Yes, correct.
So very, very excited about that one. The reactions have been just overwhelmingly positive. So eager to dive into The Last Jedi. I'll be seeing it in a couple of days, and you'll be seeing it. We'll be seeing it again. I'll be seeing it again with you a couple of days later. So I'm pretty excited about that. And then check out our next complete works, where we will be talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2007's National Treasure: Book of Secrets, the much anticipated sequel and the much anticipated 50th episode of the complete works. We should have a party of some kind. We probably won't, but we should. anyway, thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.